people who tend to be attracted to deserts have always fascinated me, because I think that deserts are places that tend to attract sort of outcasts or outsiders or people that feel left out of society for some other reason. So as a journalist, as a storyteller, you know, a place like that just has so many stories to tell.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with Lonely Planet guidebook author Mark Johansson about his book Mars on Earth, which details his travels in Chile's Atacama Desert. Usually when travelers think of Chile, they think of its cities or its mountains or its coastal regions stretching down to Patagonia, which can resemble the west coast of the United States. By contrast, the Atacama is flyover country, a place most Chileans rarely think to visit, but Mark makes the case for why it's one of the most fascinating places in that part of the world. Together, we talk about how the Atacama has some of the oldest mummies in the world and how to go about seeing them. We talk about how this desert climate is a great place to look at stars. As it happens, two-thirds of the world's land-based astronomy facilities, including many of the most powerful telescopes in the world, are based there. We talk about how NASA tests its Mars equipment there, since its soil conditions are as close as it comes on Earth to those of the Red Planet. We talk about how to approach the Atacama Desert if you go there as a traveler. We talk about the appeal of deserts in general and the kinds of people who are attracted to deserts. We talk about the geography of love and the geographical inflection points of one's own life and how Mark ended up in Chile by meeting his eventual life partner in New Zealand. Let's listen in.
My journey to Chile actually begins in New Zealand, of all places. And not only New Zealand, the tiny town of Franz Josef, which has 400 people. So I met my Chilean partner in Franz Josef, New Zealand, about 15 years ago now. And that led me to live in New Zealand for a while, live in Australia for a bit, travel around together, backpacking Southeast Asia. And eventually, a little over a decade ago, I ended up moving to his country and basing myself now in Santiago in Chile.
Now, am I right that you guys sort of met at a tourist camp, that you're both employees of a tourist camp, or?
Yeah, something like that. So it's called the Scenic Hotel. And it was one of those hotels that people kind of fly in from all over the world on big, massive tour buses. And these buses arrive in this tiny town of 400 people and disgorge, you know, 50 people from a bus. And we were both working in one of those hotels that received all those people. And I was at the front desk. He was doing, dual shifts as housekeeping and in the restaurant. And we lived in an abandoned motel nearby that the hotel put us up in. So yeah, that was the unique situation of our meeting.
No, I love that. I know so many young people who, you know, will work for the national parks or they'll work at a hostel someplace. And it's, you know, oftentimes you have these young love flings in those parts of the world. But it's interesting that this changed the course of your life. It took you to Chile. It's a 15 years in running.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I have other friends, you know, because we were all workers from all over the world working at the Scenic Hotel. And there's other co-workers of ours that ended up, you know, meeting, moving to Lapland in Sweden and other places. So it's more of a common story than you might think.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I grew up sort of idealizing the movie Before Sunrise about Ethan Hawke and Julia Delpy meeting on a train. I traveled the world for years, and then I met my wife in Kansas. So we both traveled separately from each other, but it was sort of the inversion of that. Sure. But I think, regardless of the meet cute, it's the geography of love is an interesting one. So you found yourself in Chile, and so actually Chile is such a interesting place. It sort of reminds me of the California of South America. I don't know if you would agree with that comparison.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's quite, that's one of the first things that struck me when I got here, especially where I live right here in Santiago. We're right in the heart of Chile, and it's very Mediterranean. It's very, you know, surrounded by wine regions. We have mountains on either end. So the geography is quite similar to sort of central California. And then the further south you go, it's like the inverse. You get more into what would resemble Oregon with volcanoes and Seattle getting, and, you know, even Alaska when you get down to Patagonia. So it's almost like an inverse of the west coast of the U.S.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of people, without even knowing it, they interact with Chile every day because that's where fruit comes from in the winter, right? All those California fruits on the other side of the world come up from that part of the world. Then when I traveled through, I was just amazed by the wine and the surfing. Everything just seems so California-like.
Very much so. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Lots of wine, lots of fruit, lots of vegetables. So you always have to go to the farmer's market because the produce here is great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of a land of plenty. As you said, there's sort of this Pacific Northwest area, the further you get south, and it's really amazing. It's like somewhere between Alaska and Oregon and some of those places. But you ended up going to the Atacama Desert, the inverse of that. Okay. And so what's the backstory of how you ended up becoming fascinated by this desert part of Chile, given all the places you could have gone from Santiago?
Yeah. So, you know, by the time I started writing this book, Mars on Earth, I had lived here, I think, 7 years. And I had spent much of that time going south from Santiago, as most people who live in the capital do. I mean, when you look at central Chile, between Santiago and the coastal cities like Valparaiso, you have almost, you know, 3/4 of the population lives in this tiny little pocket of the country. And when they want to go on vacation, when they dream about the beauty of the country, they're almost always looking south, towards the lakes districts, towards Patagonia, towards the greener half of the country. But it's really the north, it's the Atacama, that drives the entire economy. It's where, you know, this is a very mineral-based economy here in Chile. So all the mines are up in the north, and it always felt like this enigma to me, the northern half of Chile. So I wanted to set off to try and understand the part of this country that even Chileans themselves don't seem to understand very well. And, you know, to prove to myself that it wasn't just a land of, you know, mines and miners and sort of broken dreams of grand riches, and to see what really existed there.
Is there a metaphor for the Atacama? Is it like the Alaska, or is it the Death Valley? I mean, you think of mining in Alaska, you think of dryness in Death Valley. I don't know if there's any other American, just to sort of help orient listeners as to sort of what sort of frontier you're striking out for.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, mining makes sense to make the analogy to Alaska, but it's certainly much more like the American Southwest in terms of geography and just the American West in general. I think, you know, there's so much mining in the US as well, out on the West Coast in very remote areas. But there's also, you know, certain cities nearby to support that industry, very much like the Atacama, which has, you know, even though it's this vast and wild and quite extreme desert, there's over 1 million people who live there to support these, you know, extractive economies that exist.
Where does the Atacama begin and end? Because I was telling you before we were recording that I'm pretty sure I slept through the Atacama on a bus, like between Cusco and Santiago. I was trying to catch up with some friends. And so I'm sure I slept through part of it, but it's possible I was out of the bus. So where is north, south, east, west? What are the dimensions of the Atacama?
Yeah, it's a good question. So you'd have to have slept quite a bit, I would think, to miss the whole desert. It's about a 24-hour bus journey if I was to go there from Santiago, just to get to the heart of the desert, that is. It's roughly the northern third of Chile, which is already one of the longest countries on Earth. So that doesn't sound like much. Chile is a small country from, you know, east to west, but north to south, it's a massive country. So it's about the northern third of the country is the desert. And as I said, to get from one end to the other by land would take at least about 24 hours. But it is, as you say, it's kind of like this flyover country, this place that a lot of people who come to this part of the world don't often choose as their first stop or choose for their first trip here. It's a place that I think is very misunderstood, and that scares people, frankly, as you know, all uncomfortable places tend to scare certain travelers. But I hope that people who read this book will look at it in a different light.
Did you have an experience with deserts in other parts of the world, North America, Asia, Africa, other areas?
Yeah. So before I moved to Santiago, before I moved to Chile, I lived in Australia. And I think my like first love of deserts really happened in the outback. I just became so fascinated by all of these faraway towns that you could get to in the middle of the outback, a Cooper Pedy, where people are living underground in opal mines, or they're using the same equipment to make their opal mines to make their homes. The cultures and the people who tend to be attracted to deserts have always fascinated me, because I think that deserts are places that tend to attract sort of outcasts or outsiders or people that feel left out of society for some other reason. So as a journalist, as a storyteller, you know, a place like that just has so many stories to tell. So for me, I think the first desert that I really fell in love with would be the Outback. But certainly I've done lots of travel since then in the American Southwest, in other deserts around the world. But the Atacama obviously has a special place in my heart now.
It's funny you mentioned Cooper Petey. When I was traveling in Thailand, when I was just a baby traveler in Thailand, I met this Australian guy who worked in Cooper Petey, and he just dug opals all day. And he was a total misfit. And like he went on R&R to Thailand, and then went back and he dug opals, and then he came back. And so I'm sure that that's a topic we'll get into in this conversation, is the kind of people that the desert attracts, right? Are there desert books that you were particularly attracted to? Because I grew up with Desert Solitaire, Edward Abbey's book, Desert Solitaire, on my science teacher father's bookshelf, and just sort of grew up really being fascinated with that. Did you have a literary relationship to deserts before you sought out the Atacama specifically?
You know, I would say no, but through this journey, when I started to imagine writing this book, which took place right at the beginning of the pandemic, I did seek out those kinds of books. And that is exactly the first book that I read. It was Desert Solitaire, just because the way that he's able to describe desert landscapes, I think, was inspiring to me. Because I think for some people, they have trouble. How do you say, you know, dry, arid, there's nothing in the background? You know, how do you describe a desert eloquently over and over again, page after page? And I think that book is the perfect example of how to do that, and was inspiring to me. But in terms of before setting off to write this book, I don't think I had a strong literary connection to books about deserts per se. Because there aren't that many, honestly. There's a lot less of those kind of books than there are about cities or forests or oceans or other parts of our planet.
No, I think there'll be a parallel here between, like, touristically, you know, the people seek deserts less probably than cities or forests or things like that. I when I was looking through, I just have a weird penchant for desert books, but like The English Patient really interested me, the idea of this guy crashing in the desert and making sense of the world, that a guy working in the desert. Also, Chatwin talks about deserts in Patagonia, and I think the song lines as well. Ellen de Botton talks about the sublime in his writing. So and then actually the Bible, like the original desert book, right? You know, of people going for spiritual motivation. So what's your short list of books to read about the desert besides your own?
Oh, it's a very good question. I think you've hit on a lot of them. You know, I have my qualms with some of those, though, particularly the chat ones, because I think he learned from his first book. He learned from the earlier book in Patagonia, because if you read that, he's explicitly seeking out the European communities who live in Patagonian desert. And there's hardly a word in there about the indigenous communities. And I think he remedies that perhaps in Song Lines when he goes to the Outback in Australia. But that was certainly something that, having read that, I, you know, use that as a something not to do in what I set out to do in my particular book.
Well, part of the reason I'm pressing is the issue is that I have this long list of desert books. Do you know Paul Shepard's Man in the Landscape? Are you familiar with that?
No, tell me.
It was quoted in Krakauer's Into the Wild. So this is one of those books I'm familiar with because it was quoted in a more famous book that a movie has been made out of. He says, "The desert is the environment of revelation, genetically and physiologically alien, sonorally austere, aesthetically abstract, historically inimical. In other habitats, the rim of the sky above the horizontal is broken and obscured. Here, together with the overhead portion, it is infinitely vaster than that of the rolling countryside and forest lands. To the deserts go prophets and hermits. Through the deserts go pilgrims and exiles. Here, the leaders of the great religions have sought the therapeutic and spiritual values of retreat, not to escape, but to find reality." Do any of those categories apply to you, or were you a pilgrim or a seeker? What was your mindset going into the Atacama?
Yeah, I think all of those things sort of wrapped up in one. I mean, to go out into the desert, you need to be a bit of a seeker, I think, because it is such a... It's an extreme environment. It's a kind of place that opens your mind to deep thinking, as I think all deserts do, just because there is such a palpable connection between the land and the sky. I mean, the sky is just so gaping in a place like that. It's such a giant hole that you can't help but, seek something or to let your mind wander and to open it up to big thinking. As I think that all deserts do, because of that connection, that allure of the empty space and how you need to fill it with different thoughts and ideas. So I think that anyone who really goes out and spends a lot of time in a desert is in some ways a seeker.
So let's jump into your explorations of the Atacama yourself. Where did you go? What approach did you have? Were you sort of at the outset thinking journalistically about it, or were you maybe more open to the spiritual things? Were you looking to examine industry or science or cultures or all of the above? What was your approach?
Yeah, so the journey itself was roughly, if we're going to put it in US terms, basically from the equivalent of traveling from San Diego up to Seattle. So that gives you a bit of a perspective of the vast territory that I was covering with this book. And within that, I tried to break up the chapters into different themes so that I could, as you say, approach different items from different perspectives. So while it's roughly geographical in terms of, starting from the south, heading up to the north, each chapter does sort of hone in on a specific area and breaks that geography up just a little bit to make a broader point. But those topics that I touch on along the way are, first and foremost in chapter two is looking at, what kind of people are attracted to deserts? Why do deserts attract these outcasts and outsiders that we've been talking about? And then from there, looking at different aspects of the geography, what makes a coastal desert like this different from other deserts around the world, looking at the indigenous communities who live there, be it the Aymara who live in the far north or the Lincoln Entai who live more in the central part of the desert, looking at the ancient history of this desert, because I don't think most people realize how much history there is scattered across this desert, Not least of which includes the world's oldest mummies, the Chinchorro mummies, which are 2,000 years older than the mummies in Egypt that most of us Wow. are familiar with. Yeah. So each chapter sort of tries to look at a different element of the desert. And I'm missing one big one that I haven't talked about yet, which is the mining industry, and in particular, lithium, which is sort of the big mineral of the moment right now that will fuel our transition, from gas-powered vehicles to electric ones. And I think a lot of people in the US and elsewhere sort of look at that idea as a good one and as a positive one for the earth and climate. But what we don't often think about is the people who live next to the places where those minerals are extracted and how that industry is affecting them. And so with this book, I tried to approach it from that angle, to speak to the communities who are living next to these new and growing lithium mines, to learn how that was impacting them, chiefly, how the water supply has been cut off from a lot of those communities at the moment.
Well, that kind of industry is an expression of modernity, I guess. Yet this has been lived in for centuries. How did people live in this desert before it became sort of a place that was focused on mining? What were the lifeways of the indigenous people who predate the modern world there?
Sure. So there's certainly a lot of smaller communities, especially the further north you go, closer to the Bolivian and the Peruvian border, who had their own villages, often made of mud bricks and grass, like totora reed roofs and things like that. And the way they often lived back in the day was trading with llama caravans. So these llama caravans would travel all across the Atacama Desert. So the people who lived by the coast would trade their fish and their sea products with the people who lived up on the Altiplano, so the high altitude part of the Atacama Desert, where they would have their jerkied meats and their potatoes and their other products. So there was always this huge industry of trade, and that trade industry basically got solidified together through the Capacnan, which is the great Inca road during the time of the Inca, which a lot of people don't realize only lasted for about 100 years. But during that time, all of these old sort of Lama trading routes got wrapped up into the Greater Inca Road, connecting northern Chile with Cusco and the Greater Inca Empire in southern Peru. By the time that the Spaniards were arriving, you had lots more of adobe kind of villages built up in different places with whitewashed adobe churches that you still find to this day in very remote areas of the Atacama, which are basically a way of the Spanish conquistadors sort of creating permanent settlements for communities who were much more nomadic back in the day.
Dumb question. Well, tell me about the mummies. Actually, why are the oldest mummies in the world here? In a part of the world we don't usually think of millennia of human habitation. What are the circumstances of those mummies?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. Basically, it's down to theories at this point. There's no hard and concrete answer, but the main theory is that this community, as it was pushing down into the southern parts of South America from the north, came across this somewhat fertile river valley called Camarones. And the river water that goes through this valley has some of the highest levels of arsenic on Earth. And so the moms were drinking that water and accidentally poisoning themselves. So their babies were being born as stillborns. And sort of the grief and the terror of that experience birthed this this mummification process, where they would basically take the organs and the insides out of a fetus at the beginning and turn it into almost like a doll that could then live with the community for months and years afterwards. And that's how the concept, it's believed that's how the concept started. And then it's spread from there. And you find mummies all over parts of South America that are quite old as well, in places like Peru and Bolivia.
What is the reputation of this part of Chile among rank and file Chileans? Like, do they have a fascination with those mummies, or do they mostly see it as a sort of a place where their uncle they never talked to works, or is it sort of the sticks, are people seen as uncultured there? Because one thing that has always interested me as I've traveled the world is that, we live in an urbanizing world, and so much of our frame of reference for everything is the city now. It's where the most educated people are. It's where media is centered. And I think the more remote parts of the world are misunderstood. And so how is the Atacama Desert understood and misunderstood by Chileans? And what did you discover that either confirmed or went against those reputations?
Yeah, it's certainly very misunderstood. To bring up your first point about the mummies, I would say the vast majority of Chileans have never visited Arica, which is the main city where you find two museums dedicated to the Chinchorro mummies. If you think about it this way, Chile never gave the mummies enough value that they even wanted to put them on the UNESCO World Heritage List until 2001. So these mummies, which have been known about for more than 100, 200 years, didn't become UNESCO World Heritage until 3 or 4 years ago, principally because they were never given the value locally to make people feel like they were worthy enough of having global value. You do find some Chinchorro mummies in museums in Santiago, and you do have this kind of conversation, like you said, somebody's uncle, somebody's friend works in the north, they go up there. Oftentimes they are fly in, fly out workers. So they fly into the mining towns in the north and they fly out. And so the reputation that the north has oftentimes among Chileans, particularly in the capital, is as a place that people go to basically make their money. And then they come back to somewhere like Santiago or their house in the south to spend that money. What I found on this journey is just how amazing the nature is, how amazing the wild landscapes are in the Atacama Desert, particularly once you get up onto the Altiplano. So the Altiplano is the second highest plateau on Earth after Tibet. It gets, it's basically where you find the epitome of what people, if they Google the Atacama, the images that come up are almost always of the Altiplano. This is where you find the volcanoes. This is where you find these turquoise high altitude lagoons. It's where you find remote hot springs. It's where you find flamingo filled lakes. It is a bit wetter because it receives some of that snow melt, and it catches some of the clouds that come across from the Pacific or from the other side. And so it's just a fascinating, fascinating place where if for somebody who likes to be alone, who hates over tourism, who likes to explore raw and wild natural places, it's really one of the most fascinating on earth, if you ask me.
Are you one of those people? Are you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, someone like you or I, or perhaps most of your listeners as well, who's traveled, you know, for a decade or two decades, or has lived a life of travel for long enough, you stop wanting to necessarily go to all the pretty, perfect, obviously wonderful places. And you start seeking out some of those places that maybe challenge you just a little bit more, that maybe get you off of the beaten path a little bit more, because you find that they are some of the most, they touch you on a deeper level sometimes, because you do have to work a little bit harder to get there. You do have to put in a little bit more research to make it work. But at the end, there's just such a big reward for that. And that reward is often, you know, being the only person there or meeting locals and them being surprised to see you instead of, you know, wanting you to get out of their town, as is the case some parts of Europe, especially these days. So yeah, I think that after years and years of traveling, these are the kind of places that I tend to seek out.
What does it feel like to be there? I mean, this is a place that there's so many superlatives. It feels like an extraordinary place. So is there a way that you can put into words how it feels different from other parts of Chile and other parts of the world?
Yeah, it feels itchy. Your skin is so dry that it looks like, you know, spider webs have crawled across your skin. You feel itchy. When you get up onto the Altiplano, you're oftentimes around 14,000 feet in altitude, around 4,000 meters. And your nose is just kind of clogged up. Your head is kind of, you feel like you can hear the inside of your head going wah, 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 because you have about 30% less oxygen. So it can be a challenging place to be in. And it does make you feel things. It does make your body feel like it is about to explode it sometimes because of the altitude, because you are so high up. That's not something necessarily specific to here, but because it is quite relatively easy to get up to really high altitude places, I think it's a part of the world that more people spend longer amounts of time at higher altitudes than most other parts of our planet. So for people who are curious what altitude does to the body, or what, you know, extreme ultraviolet radiation can do to your eyes, you know, dries out your eyes, it can dry out your skin, but you know, you just need a lot of lotion, you need a lot of patience, you need some Tylenol, and it's an interesting experience.
Tell me about the stars up there and the astronomical importance of this part of the world.
Yeah, so the Atacama Desert is now home to 2/3 of the world's ground-based astronomy facilities, which is kind of mind-blowing. But basically, because of the lack of light pollution, because of the altitude, because of the conditions there, it just has this perfect conditions to put some of the biggest telescopes we have on our planet, including two more $1 billion projects that are going to open before the end of this decade alone. So for a traveler, you can not only go and visit some of these scientific you know, telescopes and observatories and speak to the scientists who work there on certain days. You can also go to more tourist-oriented places, look through telescopes into the night sky and just, you know, probe the Milky Way, looking at it one night, perhaps from a touristic perspective, a scientific perspective, and another night from the indigenous perspective, because whereas the scientists are often looking at the light spots in the night sky, the indigenous people of the Atacama are often looking at the dark spots of the night sky. So it's a really fascinating place where you can just look up at the sky and see it in so many different ways than you ever have at your home back where you came from.
What are the indigenous people looking for in the dark spots? Or is that even sort of a industrialized Western way of asking the question?
Well, no, I mean, it's very similar to looking for constellations in the way that a lot of us might look at the night sky. But instead, you're looking for those animals or those creatures or those signs within the shadows. And those signs are often used to predict the harvest for the year to come, fertility of women, different things that many people in the Atacama would look up to the sky and search for answers, and then use the answers that they find to predict the way they're going to farm or live in the year to come.
Well, to reverse the astronomical analogy here, Mars on Earth, why? Why would you call it Mars on Earth?
Good question. So NASA, when it wants to send those rovers up to Mars, when it needs to test its instruments that it's going to send up to outer space, where it comes on Earth is the Atacama Desert, particularly an area called the Salar de Uyuni, which is just outside of the city of Antofagasta. Because what it's found is that the conditions of the soil in this part of the Atacama are most similar to the conditions of the soil up on Mars, which is to say, like, if you're going to a planet and your goal is to search for signs of life, you want to go to a place on Earth that has the least signs of life. And what they found is that the perfect analog is the Atacama. So the title of the book, Mars on Earth, kind of plays on that idea of, if you're somebody who has always dreamed of going somewhere like Mars, and you don't have the money or the time or the experience to become an astronaut and hopefully get there someday, you can just come to the Atacama and experience a very similar landscape right here on Earth.
Have you read Kate Harris's Lands of Lost Borders?
No, you're giving me a lot of good suggestions. I'm going to have to take some notes after this.
Yeah, she's it's funny. There could almost be a literature of Mars adjacent places on Earth, because she sort of grew up nerding out about science, and she wanted to go to Mars, and she went to like a space camp in the Southwest that replicated Mars. I hope I'm not paraphrasing this wrong. And then she bicycled across Central Asia, and so she had a lot of analogies in that regard.
Okay.
So it feels like there's a really specific phylum of travel literature and travel imagining that ties itself not just to desert places, but to other planets and how we might replicate them on Earth. Ooh. I mean, did you have any outer space ambitions? Do you have any space camp things going on here?
No, not at all. Although I think that this trip has sort of given me a greater appreciation for the world beyond our own planet. This much time in a desert landscape forces you to look up all the time. And so you're dreaming and you're looking at these stars and you're just so amazed by how there's so much light and so much planets and so many, Starlink satellites flying around the night sky that you just don't see if you live like I do in a city. So while I definitely didn't have any sort of aspirations of going to outer space or anything like that, I think that traveling in a desert can make you feel closer to the world beyond our orbit.
I had a little twinge of fear when you were talking, which I think is tied into the way we understand deserts. I was thinking, if you're looking up, what are you missing on the ground? Are there dangerous things in the Atacama? What's the easiest way to hurt yourself or die in the Atacama?
Lots of things. There's not a lot of dangerous animals or snakes or things that you might imagine, like in the American Southwest. There's not these rattlesnakes that are going to come up and bite you or scorpions that are going to come out and attack you, at least not in my experience. But there's certainly the danger of falling into, sand traps if you're trying to drive through remote areas. You're always having to bring with you, if you're driving up onto the Altiplano, an extra drum of gasoline because there's no gas stations for, hundreds of miles up there. People can get lost very easily. The northern Atacama is also quite similar to, for example, the southern border in the U.S., in that it receives a lot of immigration of people crossing illegally from places like Venezuela or Haiti or other countries north of Chile and South America. And so a lot of people do get lost wandering through the Atacama Desert just because it is such a vast and its formations can appear quite similar over and over again. So it's you don't have as many landmarks to guide you as you might in a mountainous forest or other parts of the world. So yes, it has its dangers, but as a traveler, it is easier to access than you might think because the Pan American Highway, which is the road that basically connects the tip of South America with Alaska, with the exception of a small patch of the Darien Gap in Panama, crosses through the Atacama Desert. So you do have a highway that goes from the bottom to the top. It's when you want to leave that highway where things get a bit hairy. But you have to leave that to see anything that you want to see.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Not only was I confined to that highway, I was asleep for much of the time I was there.
So. You have to connect. That's the answer.
Well, that's part of why this is interesting, is just sort of imagining. It's so funny. Like, how things get put into your head versus what you already know about them? Because there's a bunch of bucket list aspects of South America. Obviously, there's Cusco, you know, there's the Gold Museum in Bogota, or, you know, the Patagonia, you know. Once I had an Uber driver in Los Angeles who's from northern Peru, and he's like, Cusco, why you go to Cusco? And he started telling me about northern Peru, and it's like, oh my God, I want to go to northern Peru. I met like a friend's daughter's husband is from Romania the other day, and just the way he was talking about Romania made me excited about going there. So I do want to talk about what might be on offer for people who go there as tourists. But first, a couple of travel journalist questions. One, I think oftentimes you go to a place as a travel writer with the idea of what you might find there, but then you are surprised by something. And so what surprised you there in a way that was rewarding for you as a writer?
I don't think I realized how much life there was in terms of human life in the desert. I had always imagined the desert as a collection of wild places. And I had not quite imagined as much all the villages that you can find scattered throughout the desert, and the sort of the kind of hardy people that would choose to live, you know, above 14,000 meters in a place with some of the highest UV radiation on Earth, with winds that threaten to knock you down and blow you over. And so I think it's like any trip anywhere in the world, right? You often go because you want to see a place or experience a thing. But when you come back home, it's the people that you've met there that really are what sticks in your mind. And so for me, from this trip in the Atacama, it's really the people in these really small communities that I was able to meet along the way that just kind of blew my mind.
Well, let's roll our sleeves up and talk about this in a touristic standpoint. Like, so if somebody's vagabonding across South America, they've been down to Ushuaia and they're traveling north. They've done a little bit of surfing. They've hit some restaurants in Santiago, or maybe they're traveling south from Cusco and they've seen the Nazca lines. How would you approach having an extraordinary travel experience in the Atacama Desert?
Yeah, so I'd mentioned three things for three different types of travelers. If you're the kind of traveler who wants, you know, an easy introduction to the desert, you want to eat some nice meals when you come back from your adventures, you want to have all the sort of highlights of the desert within a short radius of time and space, then San Pedro de Atacama is the obvious choice. That's kind of right at the heart of the desert. It's where I would say 90% of all foreign tourists who come to visit the Atacama Desert end up basing themselves. And for good reason. You know, you have access to the El Tatio geysers, some of the highest geysers in the world. You have access to multiple volcanoes that you can climb up or climb around. You have the salt flats, you have the flamingos, you have llamas, alpacas, all of the sort of stereotypical things that one might come to the Atacama Desert to experience are right there. For stargazers, as we were talking about, the best place for that is the Elqui Valley, which is not technically in the Atacama proper, but in a slightly more fertile valley just south of it. That is the absolute best place to go to look at the stars from both perspectives, as we were talking about earlier. And the great thing about the Elqui Valley is that because it is this fertile valley, it's filled with wine grapes and pisco grapes. So during the day, you can go, you know, have some pisco sours, which is the traditional drink here. You can go visit some wineries. It's also the home of Gabriela Mistral's museum. She was the first Latin American woman to be awarded the Nobel Prize. So beyond just stargazing, there's all these other things you can do there as well. And then for history lovers, you have to go see the world's oldest mummies up near Arica, which is the world's driest city, and it's right on the border with Peru. And then from there, you can go up to the Altiplano to a town called Putre, which gives you perfect access to similar things that you would find in San Pedro, the volcanoes, the lagoons, the flamingos, the alpacas, the llamas. All those stereotypical things are also found just a two-hour drive away up in Putre.
And how would you go? Is this a place that you can visit like with buses and bus stops? Do you really need to rent a car? If so, is it a four-wheel drive? How would you approach this part of Chile?
All of the above. You could go by buses, certainly. Certainly, if you're going to any of those three places I've just mentioned, they're all accessible by bus. The thing is, if you really want to get off the beaten path, you're going to either have to take tours from those bases where you end up sleeping, or you could rent a bike from those places and go bike out into the desert. But if you really want to get off the beaten path, you really want to go do some hiking in some remote areas and you don't want to have to rely on a tour group, then definitely getting a four-wheel drive car is the best way to go.
Quick aside, do you drink Pisco?
Do I drink Pisco? Yes, frequently.
And where, what's the argument? Because I traveled through South America from the north, and I was in Peru and I was drinking Pisco, and it's like, oh, this is a Peruvian drink. Well, it turns out the Chileans also lay claim to Pisco. So yeah. Is there a national orientation to the drink? Is Pisco different in Chile than in Peru?
It's very different, actually. Apologies to all the Chilean people listening to this right now, but Peruvian Pisco is much better than Chilean Pisco. And the reason is there's much more rules about how you have to make Pisco in Peru. So to do Pisco in Peru, you're often having to put the name of the grape that you're making that Pisco out of on the bottle. It's almost always transparente, which is to say that it's a clear Pisco. Whereas in Chile, you're almost always getting an oak-aged Pisco that's more similar to like a cognac or something like that. Both countries make Pisco sours, but the traditional Peruvian Pisco sour would have the egg white that makes it very frothy, whereas the Chilean Pisco sour is more like icy and liquidy traditionally, although you find both styles in Chile nowadays. And if you're going out partying in Peru, you're going to drink your Pisco with ginger ale. And if you're going out to party in Chile, you're going to drink it with Coca-Cola. So, you know, different countries, different ways of approaching the same spirit.
No, I love the local alcohol as a window into culture and all the rituals that come with it. Yeah. Is there anything that I'm missing out on? Is there anything that listeners need to know about this part of the world or your experience there that would sort of broaden their understanding of what's in this part of the world?
No, I just think for lovers of superlatives, as we've been talking about, you know, if you're somebody who wants to climb the world's highest volcano, if you're somebody who wants to see the world's oldest mummies, if you're somebody who wants to see the world's clearest skies, like give this random weird part of South America a second chance, because it's, I think people who do come and visit it leave quite moved by what they see.
Is your relationship with the Atacamas one that you return to frequently? Or is it more of this heightened experience that you scratched your itch and now you're going to go back down to the more traditional parts of South America?
Well, I've been back twice since I wrote this book. So it wasn't a one and done experience for me to go and see the Atacama. That said, this is sort of the first time I've done a really long form project like this, where I spent a long period of time in one place. Most of my work generally takes me, you know, in and out of other parts of South America, mostly in the Southern Cone, Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, Peru, places like that. It's a place that, you know, as long as I'm living here and in Chile, where I've been for the past decade, I'm always going to continue to return to. It's got a special place in my heart now, but it's certainly not a place that I feel like I've scratched every surface and it's done. You know, there's always more to explore.
How Chilean are you, and how, you know, not to give away all of your future plans, but I mean, the reputation is that an American meets their partner overseas and brings them back to America. It sounds like you met your partner and now you're living with him in Chile. How Chilean are you? How given over to Chile are you at this point?
Well, I wake up later and I go to bed later. I, you know, point at things with my lips. I order my vegetables from one place, my bread from another place. I mean, just by nature of living here, there's certain things about my way of living that are much more aligned with here than back home. I've actually lived outside of the U.S. All but 3 years of my adult life. So it's an interesting relationship now that I have with going home and what home actually means anymore. I'm happy in Chile. Chile Santiago is one of the most modern cities in South America. We have great internet. I can look out my window and see some of the tallest mountains in the world. You know, the tallest mountains outside the Himalayas certainly are just right out my window. So if I want to be skiing in the Andes, I can be there in 60 to 90 minutes. If I want to be surfing on the coast or just, you know, enjoying the beach on the coast, that's another 90 minutes. If I want to go to a winery, that's 30 minutes. You know, it's the city that has a lot of great attributes all around it. And the sense that I think that a lot of people have that you're somehow less safe in South America than you might be back home. You know, if you just do a quick Google of the world's most dangerous cities, you'll find that a lot of them are actually in the US as well. So I don't think that that's a huge, doesn't weigh down on me very much.
Do you have any grain of US homesickness, or have you been away for so long that you don't even really care about Dr. Pepper or, you know, other things that might make you miss certain things that you can't find there?
Yeah, food for sure. Family, obviously, family, friends, and food probably are the big things. Sometimes they're the things that you don't even realize that you're missing, but then when you go home and you, I don't know, you see ranch dressing on a menu or Dr. Pepper, as you just said, at a, you know, a soda fountain in general, which is not very common in this part of the world. So there's often things that I don't realize I miss until I'm back home and I feel this, tug of nostalgia for something that I grew up with and would love to have more of in my life, but it just isn't a part of my life anymore. And it's been so long at this point that So yes, to answer your question, yes. But there, there's trade-offs to living anywhere in the world, and there's good things and bad things. And you can spend your whole life thinking about, you know, what's better in one place and what's better in the other. But for me, it's just better to enjoy where I'm at when I'm at it.
Yeah, no, my wife was asking me the other day, she's like, oh, you wrote your first book, Vagabonding, in Thailand, didn't you? And it's like, yeah, well, what if you'd stayed there? Like, what if you'd become one of these digital nomads who are always reading your book? And it's like, oh my gosh, that's a good question. I don't know. Because in choosing the place where you are, you sort of choose the life you live. And like, I wouldn't have met you because I met her in Kansas. And so it's sort of funny to sort of be imaginative in one's relationship to where one finds home.
Absolutely. I mean, I can look back, and I'm sure you can too, at all these different points in my life. And if I had made one other direction or one other decision that wasn't the one I made, my life could have gone off in 1,000 different directions. You know, I think for anyone who spends a bit of time traveling around the world, living in certain parts of the world, they can look back at their life and look at these inflection points where it could have gone one way or the other. And all of those, you know, little decisions in the moment led to this big decision of how your life ended up. So yeah, it's interesting.
Little did you know when you got that job as a hotel clerk in New Zealand, right?
Absolutely, yeah, totally.
What can you leave us with for people who might sort of be engaged by the idea of this part of the world and the book you wrote about it? What can you leave listeners with?
Yeah, one thing I'd say just more broadly about South America in general is, you know, I think a lot of times, especially in the US or Europe as well, the news that comes out of this part of the world isn't always the nicest or the best. You know, you hear a lot about crime or drugs or basically any sort of problem that's originating in this part of the world. And what you don't often see is sort of the beauty and the joy and the great things that there are in this part of the world. So I would encourage people to come to South America, to come, try the food, try the amazing wine. You know, every country in this part of the world has something incredible to offer, you know, great architecture, great design, you know, all these things that I think people from the Northern Hemisphere often associate with their own worlds and their own lives. You can find innovative new examples of that in this part of the world as well. And especially for Americans, you know, the story of the Americas as a whole is quite similar in terms of, you know, colonization from various parts of Europe and different communities immigrating from all over the world. So I think it surprises people when they come to South America because they expect it to be one thing and it's something completely different.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Mark Johansson's book, Mars on Earth, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.